everybody. This is Robin Ayu from the Localization Fireside Chat. And welcome to another episode. Welcome to another recording. I think this is number four today, if memory serves me correctly. I've been at it since morning recording podcast. But today, with this particular recording, we're recording episode 208, if I got the count correctly. And my guest today has spent 25 years doing the thing that most business owners quietly dread, getting HR ready. She started her career moving through some of the most demanding industries that you can name: pharmaceuticals, broadcast media, law and engineering, before founding Pegasus Evolution, which we'll talk about today as well, where she works as a bilingual fractional HR consultant and a leadership coach for small to medium enterprise, SMEs, across Canada. She is located here in the GTA area, where I am located in the Toronto area. She holds a CHRL designation and an ICF accredited coach, and is a certified in conversational intelligence. I can't wait to dig into that one, which is a methodology I want to get into because it sounds fascinating, A, and because interesting, and I've done 2-3 podcasts on this same topic, cognitive intelligence and all that stuff. So we'll try to understand what you mean by that from your own perspective. She's also, as I say, as someone who runs bilingual business myself, been in the translation, the language business for almost 3 decades, doing this work both in English and in French, which is, in this country, is not a small thing. Julie Aline, welcome to the Localization Fireside Chat. Glad to have you with
me. Thank you, Robin, for having me. I'm excited.
Thanks so much. Again, on this channel, now I did a little bit of an introduction. I'm not sure if I captured everything about you correctly, but you can correct me if I'm wrong. And as we say on this channel, Julie, everybody's got a story. Let's start with this one. What is your story? What got you here?
Well, when you're a young teenager looking for where are you going to drive your career to, I was working in as a summer student in an insurance company, and was looking at the HR manager there and started to ask him, you know, what did you do? What did you study? Where did you go? And I was just very interested in his role as an HR director. And, you know, following a bit in his footsteps, that's what brought me to HR, and I've never left since. So that's what brought me to
where you are now.
Yeah, kind of. That was the introduction.
And, you know, for the audience, it sounds a little strange. You have an industrial relation degree from University of Montreal. That's quite the departure from your education.
Yes, but I think it was a good introduction to human resources and the many, many broad facets of human resources, because it's very broad. It was a good way to start and understand, you know, compliance and labor laws. And once you have your hand on that, it's a good way to continue with the rest, which is compensation, health and safety, investigations, and, you know, regular employee relations, unionized employee relations, and so much more.
Unionized employee relationship. I remember worked for a unionized company early in my career. And I remember we were given a training as management on, what did they call the training? I remember they called it working in a unionized environment or dealing with unionized employee or something to that effect. And I remember I still can see the binder in my, every time I close my eyes, I still see the thickness of that stupid binder. It was this thick to, you know, and I remember when I was sitting in my office and, you know, I wanted to talk to, you know, let's say my secretary, we don't call them secretaries nowadays, but 4 decades ago, I guess that was the convention. And I wanted to talk to somebody about whatever issue I'm facing during the day. And I was so worried about having a conversation with one of my employees. I used to flip, I have the binder on my desk. I used to flip to the page, you know, how do I address this? Who do I talk to? What does this paragraph say? And I don't know if it's the same nowadays, but it's complicated, isn't it not, to run in a unionized environment?
Yes. Yes and no. Let's just say, yes, it can be complicated, but no, in the sense that your collective agreement really guides you for the rules and regulations that have been approved and negotiated and accepted. So stick to that realm. And it kind of is a little sometimes simpler than broad non-unionized environment.
But what I found, and we'll move away from the unionized environment, what I found over the years, as the collective agreements gets updated, the contract gets thicker and bigger and longer and more complicated. They don't get smaller with time. They don't get simplified. Maybe somebody's working on simplification right now. I have no idea.
Yeah, it rarely gets smaller. That's correct.
So you've worked in pharma industry. You worked in law firms, media, engineering firms. You even worked for funeral services. What is that? And most HR professionals pick a lane. You did the opposite. What was the rationale?
Yeah, I mean,
What did you do?
Well, I was responsible for HR for this large funeral company. They had 2,000 employees in Canada and 22,000 employees in the US. They were large. And so I was responsible for Eastern Canada, and that was about 1,000 employees. And I was the only HR person for that business. So I supported all the leaders and the market leaders in the different provinces and helped them. Some were unionized, some were not, and helped with employee relations, terminations, performance and disciplinary measures, and just the regular, you know, day-to-day issues that needed to be addressed. So yeah.
Yeah, for the audience, so what Julie's saying, I was not involved in burying anybody. I was just involved in managing their HR.
Yes. But honestly, this industry was amazing because the employees deal with really difficult work environments. It was almost like a family, and they were amazing, amazing to work with. I really enjoyed working in that industry, as funny as it sounds.
And now, when did you decide to go fractional, Julie? And what was there a specific moment that drove you there, or a customer that wanted you to go fractional? And you thought maybe there's a market to go fractional.
Well, in 2015, I started to do my coaching training and had that idea in the back of my mind that that's what I wanted to add and potentially go into full time. And in 2020, I made the big step of starting my business right before COVID, which was not the greatest timing. But there you go. I'm still here today, and it was a big challenge. But I wanted more autonomy, more opportunities to pick and choose, you know, who I want to work with, and also integrate my coaching services for executives and leadership. So I'm able to bring all of that together with my years of experience and just, you know.
And you didn't want to go full time for a company, or you prefer to do fractional?
Honestly, I like to do fractional. I think it's a better way for me to bring my expertise and have a variety of different types of clients that are at different stages in their business. And yeah, I think it works well for me right now.
And, you know, the name Pegasus on the company, it's a powerful name. I mean, Pegasus. Does it mean anything to you personally, or why did you choose the name?
Yes. Yes, it does. First of all, it is part of Greek mythology and also a constellation. But for me, it relates to the Pegasus horse, which is there to support the gods in helping humanity evolve. And I see myself as the Pegasus. So there you go.
There you go. I think we got to the root cause or the root reason for Pegasus' name now. Thanks for sharing. I really appreciate that. Because a lot of times people pick names for their companies and, you would wonder, like, how did they come up with the name? And I remember when I picked my company name, N49 Networks, I was just going through some discussion with some people. And I picked N49. And this is just at the time when we were going through the friction between us and our neighbors to the north as Canadians. And I thought, okay, North of 49, that's the name of the company now. So I called it North of 49. I'm not South of 49. I'm North of 49. Yeah. It's a great distinction. You know, time, I guess, plus location equal name, I guess, in my case.
Yes. And it's funny because I just created a networking chapter, which is part of a larger networking group. And I named it the North Star Collective. So, cool. You know, how you name your things. Yeah, it's the North Star Collective because we are part of the Northern North America and higher than the 40.
Yeah, that's right. So your company, your services targets companies between 20 to 150 employees, too big to wing it on HR and too small to justify a full-time certified HR professional. Can you walk me through what actually happens in a business when it actually hits 125 people? What breaks and why is the inflection point where HR stops being optional?
Well, I think HR is never optional. I think it should always be a part of the business, whether it's on demand or as a fractional or as a full-time employee, depending on the nature of the industry and the business and the requirements. Yeah. Normally they say, I'm sorry about that.
Okay. Don't worry. These things happen on the podcast. I've seen it.
So sorry about that. So I think the issue is when you get to over 125 employees, you really should have a full-time HR person to deal with employees and everything that comes with it. Under that, you could get away with, you know, administrative people and part-time HR people that can help you. But after a certain size, it just gets too demanding and you need to have that foundation to support and create systems and processes to just simplify the life of the business and the cycles of, you know, how do you recruit? How do you manage performance and everything that goes with that?
And have you done any conversations with business owners, Julie, on the ROI for HR in general? Because some people, like I've spoken to some owners, not just HR, they view all the other services like IT, finance, HR, all this stuff. They find it, it's an expense on the business. But there must be some return on investment, sort of a calculation in there to justify it. Have you gotten through these conversations with some of the owners and what was the reaction?
Yes, it's always hard to convince people of the value that there is in HR. The thing is, it's compliance, but it's more than compliance. It's also the cost of not being compliant. You know, when you handle terminations fairly, pay people accurately, create a psychological safety, you're not just avoiding lawsuits, you're also building trust and the trust that retains your best people. So it's an investment. And unfortunately, people kind of, you know, put this in a nice to have, but not necessary until something really, really bad happens. And then, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines because, you know, they terminated somebody the wrong way or, you know, had some workplace accidents or didn't pay people properly and now have to pay fines, you know, going 5 years back. Like there's all kinds of scenarios where, you know, it could even compromise the existence of your business.
And what about if they were on a growth spurt, not necessarily running steady, but if you're experiencing a revenue hockey stick kind of a graph, you probably need HR for growth purposes as well, like to hire, to select, etc., which becomes part of your dynamics, if you will, right?
Yeah, you know, in scaling your business, what got you to where you are today is not what's going to get you to that next level. So you need to prepare. You need to build your bench strength. You need to have your leadership ready and have them prepared to manage bigger groups of people and, you know, plan and prepare for that.
Now, I love the phrase that I think you've mentioned this before in previous conversation, come for the total compensation and stay for the culture. In your experience, how many business owners are genuinely believe that? Do they believe it versus the ones that they're just repeating it for whatever reason, I guess?
I would say it depends on the individual leader, business owner. Some are truly, truly invested in creating a people first culture, and some are more the people are there to do their job and we're paying them for them to do that, and we don't really care about if they enjoy working here or not. So yeah,
but that's hard truth. I mean, this is reality, right? I mean, you're not saying something outside of the reality here. It is true that some business owners, hey, I'm paying you a salary, come in, you do your job, and you go home.
Yes.
But some people, they worry about how much that person is vested in the job that they're doing, because they feel like if they are vested in the job they're doing, they do a better job. And they believe they can produce more passionate job, I guess.
100%. I do think personally that you will get a lot more out of your employees if you create that, you know, psychological safety, well-being, and they'll be happy to give you more than just, you know, I'm here from 9 to 5 and 5 my pen drops and I'm out of here.
Yeah.
You know, if you give a little more in terms of, you know, the support and the safety and the tools they need to do a great job, you yep. will get that back. That's my perspective. And I try to, in building those environments.
Now, you just reminded me of the 5 o'clock thing. I had an episode in what was it? In New York. We had an office there at one point. And I walk into the office and there's an employee sitting at his desk around 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Literally 5. Like I looked at my watch and it was exactly 5 o'clock. Now the phone is ringing and the individual will not pick up the phone. And I said, so can I ask you a question? He said, what? I said, how come you're not picking up the phone? The phone is ringing. He said, well, I know who's calling. I said, oh, you don't want to talk to your wife or something? He said, no, it's a customer. I don't want to talk to them. I said, now you need to call. Now you need to respond. It's your customer. He said, you know, what do you think is going to happen if I answer at 5? Tomorrow they're going to call me at 5:30. So I'm training them not to call after 5. In his opinion, he's training the customer not to call. Not to call them at 5 o'clock. Oh my God, I almost lost it. Just crazy stuff people come up with. And you need to set those boundaries or culture or whatever you want to call it. Not necessarily rules, because we're all adults and we're all professional. We all know what we're doing, hopefully. But at the end of the day, there are some people out there that they run solo in the way they think about things. And they create their own rules in the process. Now, Julie, you have something called the HR Pulse Check Diagnostics. Talk to me a little bit about that one.
So the HR Pulse Check is a form or a survey to look at where the business is at. What do they have in place? What do they not yet have in place? And to show the gaps that exist and where they should be starting, you know, what's the next step for them to ramp up their HR compliance and their HR tools in place. So it really is about, you know, looking at all of that and preparing for, okay, you've done some work, but there's a lot more to be done. So let's start at where you're at.
So basically take a step and assess where you are and figure out what needs to be done.
Yes.
Now, after what, you know, I'm assuming like everything else, after you fix what's broken or build what's not being built, there is a maintenance phase, right? Did I get this correctly? Like after, do you do like a bit of maintenance, ongoing maintenance? Oh,
yes, of course. Every year, first of all, the employment labor laws are adjusted, and we need to make sure that we're keeping in line with all of that. But of course, businesses grow and change and priorities change. So it's re-evaluating, you know, what's in place and is it still serving us? We're not building be the police. We're building HR to support the business growth, to bring the business to where they want to be. And we're business partners. We're there to support the leadership and, you know, their targets and goals and productivity and customer service excellence.
Going by memory, what is the most expensive HR mistake that you've seen in a growing company?
Choosing the wrong HRIS tool.
Yeah. That cost.
Yes. I've seen corporate choices that were, boy, like major, you know, almost $1 million mistakes.
Wow. So you
people not being paid properly for years.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Years. You know, thinking.
Do you remember the program HR? It was an ERP program, but part of it, it was payroll and HR and a bunch of other things. Government bought it and it was all over the news. It was bought from IBM. I think they called it the Phoenix Project or something like this. I can't remember what it was.
I don't remember that.
Do you remember that one? And it took them like, I don't know how many years, and people went home with no pay and a bunch of things. It was like a large scale mistake, I guess.
Yeah.
Problem. Then they fixed the mistake later.
No, these are, you know, the wrong people choosing the wrong systems for the wrong reasons.
What, Judy, where does recruiting fit within the HR cluster?
Well, it's actually the first element that we look at in terms of supporting leadership and hiring the right people in the right roles at the right time. And it's essential. It's where the real partnership starts in building the teams and hiring the right people. Mm-hmm. So it's essential.
It's part of HR, basically, you're saying?
Yes, yes. Many businesses have a separate department, but it's come very much linked with HR. But they would have like a recruiting team if it's a larger company.
In the age where everything is being outsourced, as you know, do you think companies should hold on to their HR department or outsource it completely out?
I would say that it really depends on what size and the nature of the industry that they're hiring in. Sometimes it really gets very, very difficult and very, very time consuming. So when the talent is very rare, it might be interesting to, you know, and some businesses have a hybrid approach. They have their HR team, and once their team is not successful, then they hire outsourced HR recruiters that are specialized in a specific area. So I see that quite often right now happening.
One thing that you talk about is conversational intelligence. Can you talk a little bit more about this one? What is your definition of this and what's your version of it?
So it's about building leadership capacity. So with my ICF coaching credentials, it gives me the structure and the ethics for executive development. But the conversational intelligence, the CIQ, is where the neuroscience comes in. It's based on Judith Glaser's research showing that the conversation literally changes brain chemistry. So oxytocin, you know, the happy hormones in your brain fostering bonding and collaboration, and cortisol, which is the stress hormone, triggers fear, fight, flight, or freeze area. So yeah. There's the neuroscience research backing this industry or this area of expertise. So there's kind of like three levels of conversation based on the CIQ strategies. Level one is transactional. Level two is positional. And level three is transformational. So it's where we're bringing the person in front of you. Like, let's discover something new together. And this is where the breakthrough happens instead of a win-lose or a low-trust, high-efficiency relationship we may have. So it's kind of like well-being is a performance metric where it really helps to build that bridge with having better conversations.
And what does that look like from a real interaction in the workplace? So if I was a manager and I want to apply this conversational intelligence and then what you just defined there, how do I do that?
It's like digging a little deeper of the surface conversation we're having. Like we double click into digging deeper.
And down the menu?
Yes, yes. So it's using words like accountability or respect, but going down into, okay, what does that mean for you? And really going deeper in those conversations, using the same words, but just digging.
Yeah. Have you seen this TikTok trend? I can't believe I'm saying that. Where you've got they've got like these cartoon videos where an HR person is talking to an employee, but they're talking through a translator. So the translator is translating I got to send you this one. The translator is translating corporate language into a real language that the employee can understand. Oh my God, I laugh so hard when they speak the corporate language and the individual saying, I don't know what they're saying. What are they saying? You're fired. or you're not getting a salary increase.
No, I haven't seen that one.
No, I'll send it over. Now, when we say, as you mentioned before, well-being is not a soft topic. What is the case there? What is the business case for that?
Well, if your employees are not, you know, doing well, it's going to be hard to get the best out of them, right?
But a small business owner probably will say, hey, I'll replace them.
Yeah, but the price of replacing people is very, very expensive. It's a minimum of $30,000, minimum, for replacing one employee. So if their salary is higher, then it's more than that.
Plus the training and et cetera, I'm assuming, right?
It's the recruiting cost, the time where you have an empty spot, the cost on all the other employees that have to take over their work, the demotivation, the choosing the right person, training them, having them perform at the level you want them to perform, all of that. And so $30,000 is really a low estimate.
When you work with managers, Julie, that assuming in this case damaged their team trust, what is the first thing you do?
Try to repair that trust. It takes years to build trust, and it takes 2 minutes to destroy it.
Yeah, I used to say you can't walk off the street to somebody and say, hey, trust me. That would be the wrong statement.
So investing in leadership training is definitely a big priority, in my opinion, for businesses that have different levels. Not a small company, but if you have managers, investing in the expectation and the duties and the responsibilities that come with that higher salary, and that's important.
Now, in the leadership efforts that you do, leadership coaching efforts that you do, is in general, in your opinion, is leadership coachable? Or are there some people out there that you sit down with and say, I don't think anything's going to change here?
I think it's coachable as long as the person is wanting it. If they're not interested in it, it's not going to work. But you can learn it. You can. It really depends on if you want to learn it or not.
Because some people like drift into leadership and by promotion, right? They're not really selected based on leadership quality or traits.
They just
happen to be in the right place, the right time, at the right salary. And somebody hires them and they say, okay, not hire them, actually promote them. Now you're the leader of the team or something. And, you know, some people are built for that. I'm not saying everybody who drift into these positions are bad or not built for it. Some people are built for it and they just drift into this position. And you feel like it's a shoe in. They're doing well. They agree. Great work with their teams, etc. But some people don't. And these are the people that probably their CEO or somebody up higher up would say to somebody like yourself, Julie, hey, we've got this individual, you know, we've promoted them and probably need some work. Can you go work with them? And those are the individuals that probably consume a lot more time from your side because, you know, how should I say that? Teaching an old dog new tricks takes longer.
Yeah. The typical example, you have a really wonderful salesperson that's excellent at what they do, and they get hired into being the manager for the sales team. Well, they're a great salesperson, but they may not have the abilities or qualities required to be a great sales manager. And so that's when, you know, people are being promoted very often for the wrong reasons. And they may, some have the abilities and some don't. And so some, I would say, personalities are better fit to be managers than others. But if you want to learn to be a better manager, you can. I think it really depends on your perspective and if you want to.
If that's a goal for you, right? So you need to want it first. If somebody's forcing you to it, you're not going to be able to learn it.
No. Sometimes I'm brought in as a leadership coach to guide people into being better leaders, but it's more like there's a stick and there's a carrot, and I'm in the middle, you know? If they don't do well, okay.
We're going to offer you the training, but if you're not going to do well in the training, then what?
Yeah.
You're going to find another job. Let's talk a little bit about Bill 149, which you and I have addressed before in other conversation.
Yes.
In Bill 49, just for the audience, as of January 1st, 2026, Ontario employers with 25 or more employees must, 1, include salary or salary range in every public job posting, the range cannot exceed $50,000 unless the role pays over $200,000. So you can't put a wide gap. You have to narrow the gap of your salary expectations or your salary offer. Disclose whether, that's number two, disclose whether AI is used in screening. So you make sure you tell in the job posting if that's happening or not, and disclose whether the vacancy is real or speculative. Sometimes people are trying to build a pipeline of resources. You have to include that now. You can't just say, I'm hiring, but you end up saying you're not hiring. It confuses
people. There's no real job offering. It's just we're building a pool of candidates. And that can be very, you know, discouraging for a candidate that's looking for a job when there's no job actually there at the end of the interview process.
No, this rule has been in effect since January 1st, so we're almost 4 months in. What's your read on this? Like, where are we now from an Ontario employers with 25 employees or more? Are they actually in compliance, or is there anybody auditing this, or what's where are we? Have you seen that? Have you seen the effect of it?
Yeah, I've seen some employers being compliant, not all. And I do think there
So what happened when they're not, Julia? Do they get like a penalty or something?
There are some investigators, but I think they're very few and far between. The penalty, I haven't seen anybody receive any penalty for that at this time. Is it possible? Yes. I think they're just trying to slowly roll it out so that people are more and more transparent, which I think is the right way to go, but it's we're not there yet.
It should be like a normal business practice. It should not be put into a law. I mean, businesses should know that. It sounds so logical. Like when somebody applies and they don't get the job, send them a letter. You don't need the government to tell you that.
No, I know. I don't know what to say. It's like the recruiting teams are, you know, stretched more and more. And sometimes it's just a time management thing. But yes, it should be the minimum of, you know, don't ghost your candidates that you've had an interview with. Give them some feedback. And there's a lot of ghosting on the employee side as well. The candidates are applying and then not showing up. So it's trying to bring in a bit of structure and professionalism in this whole recruitment process.
So the salary range is a bit, I want to say, controversial or not controversial, I guess. From what I'm hearing, it's been talked about a little bit more now. Is there a pushback on your side that you're seeing from business owners? You know, things like we don't want to show our hands, sort of like playing poker, and they want to keep the information to them, they don't want to put it out in public because they're afraid their competitors will copy it or something.
There might be that, but I think some small businesses just don't have a range.
Yeah.
They're not structured. So there's no range to share because there's no range.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'll pay you the leftovers after I take my salary.
So yeah, I think it's you know, bringing the level of professionalism in the businesses that have 25 employees and more. And as the business gets bigger, that gets implemented, but you know, the small businesses, I'm not sure they'll be able to follow this requirement as of day one.
And what do you think of the AI disclosure requirement? That's fascinating, in my opinion. Most businesses not even realize that the applicants' tracking systems are being used right now are using AI to track them. I mean, do we know, does the employer know that the perhaps the candidate is using a lot of AI to build their credential, their CVs, their LinkedIn profiles, etc.?
Yeah, so it's on both sides. Employers need to disclose what process they're using, and employees or candidates are using AI to build their resumes and letters to fit in, you know, the keywords that they know AI is using to recruit. So it's like everybody's doing it. So it's, you know, I think it's okay to disclose it.
But did we have to put that in a law though? Like, I mean, this is like to codify it into a law that goes in. Like, this is also, it's like saying, oh, you know what? If you're using Microsoft Word, I want to put it into a law now. The government of Ontario is going to say, please tell me you're using Microsoft Word or not. The technology is here. I mean, I'm from a tech perspective. Well, today it's going to be, what's going to be tomorrow? But the laws are not going to change every 6 weeks. I mean, these things are permanent.
Yes. The thing is, I think some AI software behind it can be discriminatory when they do selection processes. So I think they're trying to just protect themselves and saying, we are using this. and, you know, it's the software's fault.
So we can go back and say, oh, it's not my fault. This is fascinating, because every time, like, I do this AI exchange networking on Friday morning, we talk about AI, what's new, what's changing, et cetera. It's a global thing. And one of the things we talk about is, like, it doesn't matter who does the work, your agentic AI or your robot, I don't care. You're still responsible for it. Like, you can't just say, oh, you know, AI did this, not me. It's under you.
Yeah. You chose that tool and it represents you. So yes, you have to absolutely be accountable for, you know, the process that are in place.
Yeah. You know what? The ban on requiring Canadian experience, that's also a good news. I think it's a good news because, you know, being an immigrant to the country, I suffered through that 40 years ago. But, you know, I think it's overdue. But how do they enforce that? Like, what is the auditability of it? Again, like the other one.
You know, it used to be in job descriptions, they would say, you know, Canadian experience required. So that's not legal anymore. So I think it's just to prevent that, and to bring the barrier down of, you know, I have equivalent competencies from another country and these can be transferred into, you know, applying to this job in Canada. So please give me a chance. And you know, it's...
No, it's a good thing. But I'm sure some people would try, or some employers, I don't know how, you know, well, no, like, beside you and me talking about it right now, I am not sure how many people know about Bill 149.
Yeah, it's not very publicized. No, it's not. So I think HR experts know, but everybody else, no.
Maybe we should put you on the podcast here once a year, bring us all the new...
Happy to do that.
Laws every year as they get updated.
Yeah.
You know, like, the other one too is like the 45-day notification for the candidate, right? After you apply, you got 45 days to notify the candidate. I love that one because I went sarcastic in my head. And I'm thinking, like, they should have added a little paragraph. When the candidate call you, please answer the phone. Maybe that would have helped the candidate too.
I know. It's It should be... a normalcy, a professionalism.
Absolutely. I mean, do you need the government to tell you to reply to the candidate? I mean, any self-respecting individual should be able to reply.
But most of the newer laws that are coming out are due to extreme situations where businesses are not doing that.
Oh, 100%. I mean, they must have seen it before. Somebody is not following, like, extremely out there. If it's one or two, nobody would put a law against it. If it's 20%, nobody would put a law. But if 80% of the people are not, you know, complaining to the government, I can't find a job, I applied, nobody answers. You know, imagine, you know, a regular citizen going to their, you know, representatives at the local government or federal government and saying, hey, we're complaining about the economy, can't find jobs, etc. Did you apply for a job? Yes. Well, and I don't hear from anybody. We apply, we put stuff out, and nobody replied to us. So the representatives continue hearing this, and that's not a new one. They've been hearing this for a while. So they got to put a law against it.
Like the right to disconnect, you know, not expecting your employees to respond at 12 o'clock at night to an email that you've sent them, because you have the right to rest and, you know, you don't have to have your cell phone under your pillow and answer the phone when your boss sends an email at, you know, 12 o'clock at night. So was it necessary? I don't know.
Hey, like, some people wants to work at 1 o'clock at night, and not because they want to work at 1 o'clock. No, it's just they can't sleep. All right. Whatever. And they send emails. I was the guilty one. I'm not expecting anybody to answer me, but I'm up. I've got many things I need to push out in terms of tasks that people need to do the next day. I'm not expecting anybody to answer, though. And that's because, or they happen to be working in different time zones too. So that's another one.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, that's where we, you know, the laws are being implemented based on, you know, some people exaggerating and overdoing it. Some businesses did have that requirement that you needed to answer within 5 minutes. And no, that's not okay.
No. And you know, the service industry is guilty for that too, right? So I worked for many decades in the language industry, and, you know, some contracts we sign with customers are asking the service provider to respond within 1 hour. So they roll down effect onto their employees that you need to respond because I've got a customer waiting and they need an answer for in less than an hour. create that cascading effect, I guess. Yeah. You know, setting it up at the top, I guess.
But there has to be boundaries too, you know, like
what
then
do you
have to hire people in different time zones that can, you know, work the 24 hours that you need to, a person to be on call. That's okay then.
So what do you think of AI inside the HR from a hybrid perspective? And I'm speaking here about workflows, tools, screening tools, policy generators, and engagement surveys. Where do you think AI is playing right now? Where do you caution against it? And where do you think we should use it more?
I think AI is a tool that is very useful. It needs to, it's kind of like a colleague that I work with, but is it my 100% all in all that whatever they give me, I take at 100% face value? Absolutely not. It needs there to help you, you know, guide you in creating documents in a faster way, but you have to revise it. You have to make sure that it's compliant. You have to make sure that it's not giving you stuff that doesn't apply to you or your, you know, province or state or country. So it's helpful, and I don't think it's going away, neither for HR or any other department in a good business. I think it's a tool that we need to really seriously look at and guide people in how to use it properly and make sure about confidentiality and all those elements that are essential. But I don't think it's going away. I think it's definitely here to stay.
And what do you think HR in two environment, remote working and hybrid working environment, how do you, is there a difference? And how do you manage that?
I think, yes, there's the hybrid environment in the sense that I think it's a good way to, a lot of businesses are bringing people back in the office. I think hybrid is a good balance between having this in-person connection and building the relationships and feeling the energy of, you know, the other human beings beside you that are essential, but the flexibility of also working from home is really, really a nice to have thing. And people who force people to come back 100% back in the office are penalized and people don't like it. And they'll find another job elsewhere that offers hybrid.
So you and I work in the fractional world. What do you think of being fractional? Obviously you like it. You've been at it for many years. And do you think the world, is this where the world is moving? Do you think people are going to be moving toward fractional versus full-time?
Yes, 100%. There's the businesses are more and more interested in paying for what they need and not having a full-time person, full-time resource. They're going to go and pay for the expertise, and the experts are interested in having flexibility and being able to bring their expertise, but just as needed or in a you know, part-time way. And I think it's definitely the way to go. And I think there's, I don't know, 55% of jobs, you know, will be reshaped with AI, and that will definitely bring more and more fractionals into the job market.
I tell you, like, I left my corporate job October, November last year, and since then I have not stopped, to be honest with you. And many companies are reaching out. I didn't even try to sell or anything. I just, you know, they noticed that I changed jobs on LinkedIn and I became independent. And so there's a lot of people reaching out on the being CRO side of things. Like they want to get their, you know, either their sales structure in place, figure out what to do with their sales teams. Do they have the right sales teams in place? Do they have the right go-to-market strategy, et cetera? So I really feel this is where you're absolutely right, correct in saying, you know, and the other, and the business case writes itself, you know, like, you know, for companies to hire a VPHR, that's not a small task. That's quite an expensive endeavor to do. And it doesn't matter if you're small or large organization, it's still a big chunk of your revenue. And to hire a chief revenue officer, that's another big chunk of revenue. But do you need the expertise? And the answer is yes. Do you want to buy part of the expertise, not all of it? This is another option too. You don't have to buy the entire slew of services that this individual could have or skills that can offer. You may want to buy like a chunk of it, a small piece of it. I don't know, design my HR policies instead of saying, redesign my entire HR process. So you can just go in and parachute in and do a project and come out, and that's fine.
And you're paying a fraction of the yearly salary you would be paying in a full-time person that has 25 years experience at that level, you're getting that expertise at, you know, it's a no-brainer to use it for what you need. And it's a win-win-win situation. So definitely is more and more popular. Fractional CMOs, CFOs, COOs, CMOs, like etc. There's whole networking groups of fractionals. It's very, very in vogue, we could say.
Yeah, yeah. And if you could change one thing about how business owner views in Canada on HR, what would that be?
Yeah. Surround yourself with people you can trust who have the expertise that you don't have that can really help you focus your business where you can delegate to that trusting person and you can focus on growing your business, scaling your business, bringing it to where you want to go. But, you know, like you have an accountant, like you have a bookkeeper, like you have a corporate lawyer, get that extra help with HR, and you will see how it can really help your business grow.
I want to thank you so much for joining me today on this journey of recording this particular podcast, Julie. It's a pleasure always to see you. I've met you face to face. We've talked on the phone a couple of times or on camera a couple of times. Thanks for joining the Localization Fireside. What do you think of the conversation?
I love the conversation, and thank you for having me, Robin. It was a really, really nice conversation.
I appreciate your time. Thank you. It's been magnificent to have a chat with Julie, and I look forward to further conversation. Again, I wasn't joking. If you ever want to come back and do an update on what changed in the HR world in Canada, I would love to have you on the show again. Consider it your channel. Anytime you need it, it's here for you. Julie, it's been genuinely useful conversation, not just the kind of useful where you feel good afterward, but the kind where you leave with list of things to do. And I hope the audience got a lot of that stuff that they, especially on Bill 149, where they need to keep an eye on what's going on in their job postings, etc., and how to behave with that stuff. I want to thank you on my behalf and the listeners' behalf to have joined me today for recording episode 208. I really appreciate your time. And for the audience, I want to thank you so much for listening in on our podcast and for watching us on YouTube and for reading the blog post where I summarize these conversations in a short form on robinayoub.blog. Thanks for subscribing as well. And I will see you at the next episode. Thank you, Julie. See you next time.
Thanks, Robin.